Which is cylinder heaven. We thought we'd do a lot of things on cylinders. So this particular panel is going to be really an open question and answer periods for some of the cylinder experts that we have here in ARSC, and you should feel free to pose whatever questions you want. Bill, why don't you go ahead and assemble your august panel, and we have an hour for having fun with cylinders.
Out here. Mike DeVecca around?
I'm still having breakfast. I saw him having breakfast before we left. We'll find him.
Okay, we'll go ahead. Well, Gary Galo is co-chair of the cylinder, the technical committee rather, and he asked the members of the technical committee who know something about cylinders if they wouldn't sit on a panel and entertain questions. I'm Bill Klinger, chair of the cylinder subcommittee, and I'll introduce the rest of the people. To my right is Peter Schambarger, who is ARSC Executive Director. He's a librarian and record collector who's active in the Washington chapter of ARSC. A couple of years back, Peter compiled the central article in the special cylinder issue of the ARSC Journal, in which various types of cylinders were described in great detail. Next is Seth Winner, co-chair of the ARSC Technical Committee. He's an audio engineer at the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive of the New York Public Library, where he's worked wonders in restoring historic recordings such as the Mapleson cylinders. As Winter Sound Studio, Seth produces excellent transfers of many historical recordings for reissue on CD on a variety of labels. And Jerry Fabers. Jerry's curator of sound recordings at the Edison National Historic Site. That's Thomas Edison's lab in West Orange, New Jersey. Jerry's responsible for the full range of Edison recordings at the site. His work deals mostly with preservation issues, cataloging, and access for researchers. And again, I'm Bill Klinger. I'm an electrical engineer and a record collector. I research the history and technology of sound recordings in the cylinder format. So if you have any questions about the types of cylinders, their playback, how they were recorded, how they should be stored and preserved. We've got a few people with some experience in that area. Any questions? Steve.
When cylinders are being played back, they have various ills due to their aging. One problem, or the most intractable problem that I've encountered, and I'm wondering whether you have perhaps a solution to it, or perhaps I have other equally intractable problems to discuss. The problem I've noted most uncorrectable is that of cylinders that are out of route. Any comments on how to deal with that issue? I'm not talking about those now where you can ream it out and play it, but where they're egg shaped.
So the question is, what do you do with a cylinder that's no longer round? How can you play that without having the sound all wowy and changing in pitch? Seth?
Well, I'll speak for my boss, Adrian Cosentini, who couldn't make it for this round table, but Art Schifrin had developed that playback system we use at Rodgers and Hammerstein, which uses a straight Rabco arm that's kind of suspended. And there's enough play on it that if the cylinder isn't round, the arm can move up and down with it, kind of like on a cushion. And there could be a way of doing it, possibly modifying something what the Rockport technology uses, which is over at the Sony Studios, which is an enormous turntable that weighs about 2 tons that is air suspended. It works with compressed air and vacuums so that the whole turntable floats as well as the arm. In other words, the arm goes straight across, but it's on a suspension of air. So that possibly could be modified for that kind of, out of tolerance, such that, the arm can go up and down.
Yeah, Steve.
It's not tracking the out-of-ground cylinder that's a problem so much. I have a system that does similar. We use an active RFOR or old V-Box on. But the problem is that there are changes in the linear speed as a result.
Right.
And so that you get a less accurate pitch variation in the course of each turn. And that's where what I was wondering whether anybody thought of the solution to equate the two problems.
I don't think we've come across anything, even in the digital domain, where you get a lacquer, as we've come across, where, you know, it was done on a cutter where it was slipping. I mean, I've spoken to Cedar, and Gordon Reed, who will demonstrate some of the new things in a couple of days, told me, he said, that is the hardest thing. Digitally, it's so impossible to try to sample something and then, like, scrunch it back and forth very quickly. Oh, absolutely. That no one has ever come up with anything in the digital domain that you can go in and correct it. Although there is a gentleman I met out in California where he took something that was 45 minutes long that had wow, that he was able to, you know, trace it. He said it took him something like 6 months in his program, shutting it on and off and then readjusting that he could bring something back in. But it's a very tedious process at this stage of the game and very crude.
So, Steve, your concern really was the geometry of the surface of the cylinder, that it's lost its original shape, right?
Yeah.
Are you speaking of like a blue amberol made of celluloid in which maybe some of the plaster core is missing and then the celluloid has shrunk in an irregular manner?
Various problems of variations in the linear speed.
Right. Yeah, some people have gone to great lengths. Joe Pengelly has actually taken the plaster out of the inside of blue amberols and put them onto a forming mandrel so that he would then expand that outer surface and restore the shape.
Yep, that works fine for that type of record, but it's where it seems to be more of a problem is in the waxes.
Right.
Michael has come.
Jerry.
One thing I'm looking into right now is just beginning to research the possibility of having a machine made in the United States for the site. And the one thing I wanted to do here was just trying to get an idea of who else might be interested in discussing possible design ideas and specifications, and just to kind of get some talk started. Hoping to, if we can get funding, I'm hoping to try to get a machine made in the next few years sometime. But if there are people who are interested in joining a discussion group, I'd be very happy to start to organize that.
You know, a variety of archives have made attempts at making a cylinder playback machine, and sometimes they were limited in the sizes, the shapes of cylinders that could be played. Other times they really weren't durable enough, or they couldn't be used by untrained people. And I think that that would be something that would be nice to help Jerry better define what are the criteria for a nearly universal playback machine that would be rugged, easy to use, and would be durable enough to last for a long time. I know that the Library of Congress and others have been dissatisfied with machines that they've tried because they may have been designed by an engineer or a mechanically oriented person, but when they had to be applied over a long period of time by untrained people, it was hard to keep them working flawlessly. So if people have recommendations about the specifications and features that a cylinder player should have, Jerry's in that process of trying to define that now. And I think a few other archives have expressed interest in that too. Marty, did you have a question? That. I'd like to introduce Michael DeVecca. Michael's an avid phonograph and record collector who's knowledgeable about cylinder records, recording, and acoustic playback of cylinders. Other questions? Mike.
What is that coating that's on the 4-minute wax samples? And can it be cleaned or should it not be cleaned? I've heard just in the last week different opinions on that.
Sort of a whitish powdery coating that you sometimes see on a wax ambrol, that's what you're describing?
Or the dullness of film that
right.
is not always a different color.
My impression of that is that there were some oils and natural waxes still being used, even in the harder wax, and that some of those, you know, effloresced and evolved to the surface over the years. I think that especially wax ambrols that have sat for decades without handling can be seen to have that. And my personal feeling is that it could be mechanically removed with care, because I don't think you'd want that kind of powder sitting on the surface during playback. Other comments on that? Seth, do you do anything to clean a cylinder before?
It's very difficult. I think we just essentially use some sort of lint-free brush as it's turning just to pick up whatever is there.
I'm a little bit more invasive in the sense I use soft cotton.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard sorry?
Microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm an acoustic guy. This electronic stuff is too much for me, folks. Okay. Yeah, I'll close mic it. Okay. I wipe them off with a soft cotton cloth. Go to the local fabric store. I buy like 5 or 6 yards at a time, wash it, get all the sizing out, and very carefully wipe it off. Now, the problem with that is you take a wax ambrol, put it on your fingers like this, and sometimes they'll crack from the heat. But that's a separate issue. So, I mean, if it's a relatively non-valuable cylinder and you want to play it, you know, that's possibly the risk. But I have found that they vary also in durability. The ones you want to break never break, for example. But a soft cloth will do it. Plus, it works with brown wax and earlier black wax. Now, someplace I read or heard that white stuff was an insecticide or some kind of fungicide or something as well, some powder they put on. I don't know anything about that. I've just read someplace, it's one of those little fragments that sticks in my mind, so I'm throwing that out here to see where that goes.
You know, that's a very good point. I don't find those 4-minute waxes being attacked by mold.
No, they
all have uniform surfaces.
Mm-hmm. One other point, that same wax was being used in the very late so-called standard cylinders, which is what Edison was calling the 2-minute wax towards the end of production. So the main bugaboo with the cylinders isn't so much the stuff on the surface, it's the wax is very brittle and it is very heat sensitive to expansion and contraction. That's the big problem.
Tim.
Yeah, here.
My former associate, Mark Kaplan, who was a chemist, did a chemical analysis of what was in the wax ambrols, mm-hmm. and he told me that they were more like asphalt,
right?
Especially
than they were anything else. They weren't exactly the same metallic soap
right.
that they used in the earlier cylinders, and so he said it was more of an asphalt substance which was not conducive to growing mold.
Right, there was a lot less natural wax. I think the formula actually called for Trinidad pitch.
It is possible for them to mold. I've seen it where they've really been badly exposed, and you can see it. They get brown around the very bottom edge usually.
Right.
They'll get a little brown, mm-hmm. but it really has to. The conditions have to be really perfect for. And Ray, didn't you tell me that there was some kind of powder they put on, was it diamond discs or something too? Or what, there was a...
Something they call it dope.
Yeah.
What happened with the disc was that they were performing wear tests, and they found out that there were spots on the disc that did not wear rapidly. And the Edison people, they decided to try and figure out what the spots were. And they found out that this is where some perspiration had landed on it. According to Norman Speed, one of the curators, said that the people at the factory then analyzed perspiration and found out that butyric acid was one of the major components of it. And they prepared this formula with butyric acid as part of it. But, reminds me of a story, by the way. Years ago, I worked as the school librarian at the Great Neck High School. And every spring, you knew spring would arrive because the chemistry department must have had it in for the kids. And so every spring, they showed them how to make artificial grape flavor. One of the major ingredients of artificial grape flavoring, or at least the ones that they made, was butyric acid. And so all through the school, you know, spring had arrived because you get this wall of smell coming up from the science room.
I hope you all heard Ray's story. No? Ray talked about application of compounds to records, but he specifically mentioned that butyric acid was something that the Edison staff had found to be a constituent of human perspiration. Was that it, Ray? And then that came to a story, related to a story, where butyric acid is a constituent in grape flavoring. And in the high school, you could tell that they were formulating that acid by the smell of grape coming down the hallway.
No. Butyric acid.
Butyric acid. Yeah. Okay.
One of the constituents of the grape flavoring.
I have a rather odd question, although for this group it might not be odd. Has anyone ever lived to diamond disc?
Not yet.
What can we expect if we do choose to lick a diamond disc?
Right. Because none of those people are here.
Tim, that'll be first thing on the list when I get back. Now, should I do an electrical? Now, what vintage diamond disc? Because remember, they changed a lot. I have to lick one every other year, maybe, for a sample. But what's my control?
Smucker's great,
very
Tim.
Interesting point.
Yeah. Tim.
Yeah, no matter that we're off of licking diamond discs now, it's a vintage. Interested in your comments on the variety of more reasonable electrical playback devices or attachments to cylinders that are available, such as the somewhat lamented symposium machine recently, the OWL attachment that's been out for a while, and there's another one that was at the OGM show.
The Edison shop, I think.
Have you had experience with any of these or others that I'm not mentioning?
I've tried the OWL pickup, and it doesn't track well. I've found the problem with it is it's stationary,
right.
Unlike an Edison reproducer where it's floating and there's some play back and forth. But the OWL is okay for about the first minute, but then it kind of gets stuck and you know, jumps the groove here and there.
It's a real problem with indestructibles that are shrunk. Mm-hmm. It does not track well at all.
Yeah, there was something. Larry Holdridge had one he'd gotten from England, which was in a cylinder, and the playback stylus was on a pivot. And that seemed to be the most effective one. He got it some 20-odd years ago, And for the life of him, he can't remember where the heck he got it from.
There's a company...
But that seemed to be the most effective one I've seen, for at least, you know, on the original machines, the playback, as an attachment.
There's a company called the Edison Shop, who I've heard just started selling an electrical pickup that can be installed on an Edison machine.
They're really good. I'm well familiar with them, and I've used them myself. They're excellent. They track well. They have a lot of latitude in what you can make it do. He's got a website. You can hear some of the stuff that he's done. If anyone wants Rob Lomas's phone number, I've got it. But he's been developing this for several years, and he sold quite a few of them at the last Wilmington show.
Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to mention if anybody's interested and has a pen and they want to mark it down, Rob's email is edisonshop@enter.net.
Steve Smolian?
Yeah, I actually have a machine built by Lloyd Stickles, which I believe the Library of Congress also. They got Mark II, I got Mark I. This was the machine turned proper side, you know, parallel, where the arm moved parallel to the ground, as opposed to the vertical design that was the original symposium design, which apparently never has come out.
Tim, could you tell us what you've experienced with the machine?
What I was trying to say is that my experience with the Stickles version, which was, according to Lloyd anyway, the basic design, regardless of what direction it was moving, of the one that Symposium finally did come out with, mine seems to work fine for the standard diameter cylinders. I haven't had occasion to use it on any of the wider ones as a way of literally cranking the arm up over to raise the height of it so that you can replace the mandrel and you don't have to remove the arm, so forth and so on, if you're playing any of the wider diameter cylinders. However, that seems to be, in relation to the earlier question about building one, that seems to be the sticking point, if that may be the right expression in this context, where trying to build a universal machine makes the job so much more complicated, and the results so much more flaky and unpredictable, than just building a machine to do one size, to get away from the one size fits all approach and build a sequence of machines, and that way you eliminate at least some of the variants that can cause problems, especially if they're being operated by people who are not trained in or experienced at the machine, and it may not be substantially more expensive to do so. And it may be the wisest course may be for one central place, especially if the group of archives, to handle all the 5-inch stuff and build the machine for that purpose, and that everybody would have a machine to play those that were most widely distributed. Because I suspect that there's an awful lot of time and money being spent to save a few odd items proportionally, maybe 1 or 2% of what everybody really has to deal with. And to focus more closely may give you a machine that would be more readily available, easier to design, and could be coming off the production line more quickly.
Okay. Tim, did you want to say something about the symposium machine?
No, actually, I'm not sure I agree with that. Based on the symposium stands a cylinder on its end, if you may know, and cracks from the bottom up, because the guy who devised it is eccentric, I guess. through a series of weights and counterweights and so forth, that composite tracks reasonably well there. It also has interchangeable standard size, salon size, and grand size mandrels, which work fine. The machining of the parts is extremely fine. It all fits quite smoothly and works very well.
problem with the machine, in my experience, and a couple of others I know who have it, is that the drive system on it is quite primitive. A very small electric motor and a rubber gear system, rubber belt system, which leads to noticeable loud flutters, no matter what you put on the machine. Simply, there's no governor, and the whole belting system is crude. That's the problem. In addition to raise and lower the cartridge and the parts of it takes a certain amount of dexterity, simply because of the way that part of it is designed.
It still scrapes along the keystroke.
If you're not careful, again, if you lower it, it can scrape along the keystroke. The interchangeability, however, of the mandrel sizes and the adaptability of how far and how the cartridge seats on the cylinder is fine. That's not a problem. And for that reason, I think a multi-purpose machine, I would think, would be rather practical if you can solve these other problems. Mm-hmm.
Is there any saying that machine is in production?
this way. I was, after 4 years, I was about to write for my money back. You just won a lottery to get one of my small number of machines. coincidence, I guess. And I'm not sure if he's selling additional machines on order or if he just pulled another deal.
Or it's a lottery.
I don't know.
Jerry.
Would you stand up and have a lottery?
This is Jerry Gibson from the Library of Congress.
Was the senior engineer in the British Institute of Recording Sound, now part of the British Library. Before that was at the Imperial War Machine Club. We acquired Lloyd's machine, and we also acquired the machine I referred to a moment ago from the Academy of Sciences in Vienna, built by a man named Franz Mecklenburg. The Stickles machine has been at the library longer. It's been evaluated more closely. I find it interesting that there are two camps at the library. One engineer at the library says that it is without a doubt the very best cylinder machine he's ever seen. Another colleague says that he thinks it is less damage to the structure of the cylinder than the plate. So it depends on which way you want to go with it. The Lechleiter machine specifically acquired because of the outer ground problem. It also complements some of the aspects of the Stickles machine. In many ways, they're very similar. Lloyd and Franz talked at length before as they were each developing the machines. Their addresses are available if you wish. And if you haven't seen them here anytime you're in town, both machines are now at LC. There was a problem with the electronic machine that was taken last fall. There was a burned oil pump, celluloid, which because of customs and standardization throughout the world, it took us until this past spring to get a replacement. There was also some problem with the belt for its drive. But both machines are intended to handle all cylinder sizes from belt painter up to concert grands. They do not handle the fact they the large
aspect. You also have a Schiffen machine,
though. No, we do not have it. I contacted, I'm told that Art is now building the machine, but when I got the movement of Art to buy 3 years ago, I contacted Art and he told my name that he was not building the machine. I've since been told that he is building the machine. Price, I'd be interested in what people consider to be a working price of this. I'd also be interested in knowing who other than someone who knows about the growth of the cylinders is going to allow them to put the cylinders. So when you say that it's got to be standard or solid enough for an uninitiated, untrained person to do it, I guess it's the archivist and preservation I would question that.
Good point.
I think the most important thing along those lines is just that it's dependable so that you don't need the person that made it to be there to fix it. Mm-hmm. A person using it should be trained in handling.
Some of the things that we're starting to share some
Yeah, I spoke with Art Schiffer not too long ago about the possibility of building a machine, and he said he was willing to do it, but the price he quoted was just way out of what we'd be able to spend. He wanted above $40,000 for a machine. So.
Gary?
Gary, assuming that Art would build you a machine, do you know what Tonar people use now, because that Rapco hasn't been available for a long time?
I believe he said he had one or two of his own that he could use, you know, in his own stock. And that's what he was planning.
Yes.
At our institution, we have a small number of cylinders. We're not interested in developing this area of the collection, but we have some that were produced locally and are theoretically of local interest. Are there some options out there for us to get these reformatted someplace so that we can listen to the content?
Well, essentially just, you know, locating an archive that can play it back for you, and have them generate either, you know, DATs from it or CDRs in an unprocessed manner, so that it can be processed later down the road. Which brings me into something else, which was a little trick Jerry was witness to in David Hamilton when we were working on some of the cylinder restorations. You know, I'm a big proponent of cedar. I have all the equipment. And one of the little tricks I found in working with cylinders is that sending a stereo signal, taking off a stereo cartridge and running it through the cedar phase corrector box and letting it do a search where it locks in on the lateral noise, which generally is pretty horrendous because it's now gotten in phase, but you want to get the vertical noise. There is a phase inversion button you push which will get rid of the lateral noise. But I discovered this by accident one time when I was working on a diamond disc. And I, you know, let it do its phase correction, it seeked, and I'm listening to it, and I said, the surface noise sounds worse than if it was just, you know, standard, vertical summing of it without the lateral noise. I said, let me try something. So I turned the phasing on it to exactly the opposite number that it was sitting at in phase, and it got even quieter than if it had been taken off in a lateral mode. No, it's in a vertical mode, just off a mono cartridge. So that's another little trick that digitally you can get a little more out of these things, whereby getting the surface noise down and pulling up more of the signal by recording it in stereo, and then fooling with it in the digital domain. These are all little, these are all little tricks. Sometimes you just find out by accident.
Mm-hmm. Steve?
That actually has been the way that the Piper has been operating for years. Richard, did I see you? Yes. you simply tune it the same way and then throw it out, throw it from one switch to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily digital, it's just a way of kind of focusing the signal.
Yeah, it's a much better way of trying to get rid of a lot of the lateral noise that's
right.
In there.
Jerry.
Can I ask what the status is of the containers
here? Oh, yeah, actually.
Good question.
I wanted to mention that. I've been working for a while to get this box made. This is a archival container for cylinder records. It's based on the 1903, I dropped the box actually, container. This is a very good archival box.
That was Edison's archival box.
Don't worry, this is a replica made about a year ago. But what it does demonstrate is this was not designed for shipping. It was merely designed for collections like ours that generally sit on a shelf for years and years and aren't handled, and when they are handled, they're handled very carefully. It's the basic idea was to hold the cylinder from its center rather than around the grooves. And it holds it very loosely, which is why you wouldn't want to use it for shipping. But it's made of, I got some comments from Jerry Gibson and some assistance from National Park Service conservator who helped me compile the materials to use. It's an archival board and archival adhesive holding the board together. And this is an inert polyethylene cap. The top cap is slightly larger and loose fitting. The bottom cap is very tight fitting, so it's a pressure fit and a small amount of adhesive on the bottom holding the cap on also. And then a small hole for off-gassing. It's the best I could do in working on it for a couple years. It's not the be-all and end-all, but I feel that it's definitely better than what was available before. Yeah.
Jerry, have you seen the one I haven't seen in a couple of years ago? But, Michael Payer put one out, designed one a number of years ago that similarly solves the problem you just had with the cylinder moving up and down. Mm-hmm. He used the, for those of us old enough to remember, the old rocket ice cream cones where you sort of pushed it up from the bottom and you ate it from a chapstick. And his idea was that the original box was loose, used the same inside core and inert paper. But once you put the record in, you pressed the bottom up just till it touched it, then you glued it at that point. So it literally formed a, it couldn't move in any direction. So I don't know if you've seen it or...
No, I hadn't. I'd be curious.
I bought a few from them, and they're big, so they take up a lot of storage space, but they're built like tanks.
Yeah.
The tricky part is that he wasn't having a lot of success in selling them, so they've been rather hard to come by.
He's not a good marketer.
Well, they're like $350 a piece, I think, and the problem is a lot of cylinder collectors are cheapskates. I mean, they bought a cylinder for $3 at Boundbrook, and then they're going to spend $350 on a box. I mean, it's just the logic of the market is a little tricky sometimes. Yeah. But they're nicely made. I don't know if they were, how archival they were and all that kind of stuff. I just know they're very sturdy.
Michael Payer was the guy's name. I don't want to call him a little eccentric, but he really cares about this.
I think he's in West or East. West.
He is the one that back in the 70s decided he was going to reissue his own cylinders under the Payer Cylindrical Phonograph Company.
Mm-hmm.
And he issued the catalog and never got around to it. But he was going to formulate the wax and all that. That went by the wayside. Then he came out with this container with it.
You mentioned outgassing, Jerry. That's an unusual design change from the way most cylinder boxes operate. And it sounds like some thought went into including a hole for that purpose. Can you go into some detail on that?
This is the hole there was something that Jerry Gibson recommended. So he might want to make a comment on that. We know that the blue amberols do contain a certain amount of nitrate, and there's a question as to whether or not those should be very tightly contained. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments?
That was from my boss at the Library of Congress, Chandra Shahani. He's head of preservation research and testing. He said that 80 nitrate contains about
has been a problem with most archival ones. They work on the idea of airtight, and that has been a problem. It's one thing with wax cylinders, but it is a problem, as you said, with the blue ambrels. You do need some sort of venting, and this is the first one I've seen that actually does that. Most of the other ones you can buy in an archival setting are push airtightness.
Jerry. I'm sorry.
To the best of my knowledge, nobody's ever witnessed significant deterioration of blue ambrels or any kind of celluloid cylinders the way we see with films. And it appears that the reason that the films sometimes do that, one reel will do it and one reel won't, is because they weren't washed. They were quickly and rapidly processed, and they weren't washed properly in the first place, leaving traces of chemicals that react. But so far, I know you can smell like camphor when you open a box. But so far, and I've seen like many, many thousands of them, I have never seen one that's getting mushy
not yet. The biggest problem with blue ambrels is the plaster expands a little bit with humidity, and the celluloid shrinks, especially when it's cold. That's been the biggest problem so far. Now, that's for the first, say, 70 to 90 years. Who knows what it'll be like in the future? Jerry Favors, are those boxes available? What's the availability on those?
I have the company is called Rigid Container. They're in New Jersey, and I believe he's interested in supplying them. I have, if anybody's interested, I have the phone number.
How much, what's the general cost?
They are pretty expensive. I'm not sure exactly what he'll charge, but he charged just over $3 each.
So around $3 to $4 range, perhaps?
Yeah.
Okay.
Does he make other sizes than that?
Well, the caps are pretty much set in size. He made only this one size cap, but of course the tube can pretty easily be changed. Mm-hmm. And for example, a dictation cylinder will fit if the tube is slightly taller.
Right. In 20th centuries.
Tim.
I have a question about, I've been banging around this stuff for years, but never got a microscope up to examine the groove of a brown wax cylinder. Now, conventional wisdom is that you do not play a brown wax cylinder with the later doorknob stylus of a Model C reproducer, for instance, because it will injure it. You really must use a graphophone type ball or a Model B or an automatic type sapphire ball to play a concert record or a brown wax standard size cylinder. But then I started thinking that the Model D reproducer, which Edison issued, is always seen with a doorknob stylus.
Mm-hmm.
You see it a lot in England. They must have, they sold the concert records longer and they used the machines longer there, so see a lot of Model D reproducers, and they have the doorknob stylus. And so I started just wondering, is this a misapprehension on the part of collectors because they just assume that the stylus would injure the record and not fit properly in the groove? Or is there some physical evidence to support this idea?
I'll make a comment. To some extent, I do some of this by the seat of the pants. I played a lot of brown wax, and I use Model Cs all the time for them, albeit with glass diaphragms because I hate the copper diaphragms. And the issue isn't so much whether it's a doorknob stylus. I mean, it's a better stylus in the sense of contact with higher frequencies and all that. And I think that's why Edison went to it, and that's pretty much accepted. I mean, there's always going to be a certain amount of change in various grooves, and it's a matter of how rare is this cylinder. If it's a super, super rare cylinder, Edison's, one of the five cylinders he made, then that's one thing. But if it's Uncle Josh, playing baseball, and it's 37th copy, you play it, and it works. I mean, that's the thing. I mean,
My theory is that the brown wax is actually case hardened slightly. I do a lot of recording, and when I first shave, it's tough. And once you get past that, you know, whatever, hundredth of an inch or something, a skin, if you will, it does get a bit softer. So there's been a little bit of hardening. And in many cases, the problem with the brown wax is that sometimes there's even been a little bit of crystallization, or there's been scratches and other forms of degradation. So frankly, at that point, the reproducer you're using is the least of your problems. So,
I think everybody who's been a phonograph collector or a record collector has heard this, and it's really gentle with them. It's like, don't go into the water within half an hour of eating lunch, or you'll get cramps, which of course is not true.
I have to agree a little bit with Mike on that too. I mean, I started getting my first brown wax cylinders in elementary school when I had my first home phonograph, and I didn't realize you couldn't play it with a C, and some of those are still playable, and some of those I played quite often. So how much is it wearing without a microscope? It's hard to tell, but from audible presence, I haven't noticed a whole lot of difference either. I hate to say go out and use your C yet without knowing more, but I haven't noticed a whole lot of change on that either.
As an aside, I tend to feel more in just general handling, say for an auction or just my own personal collection, I'm a lot less nervous with brown wax in general than I am with black wax, and especially wax ambrel. Brown wax is actually quite durable material. You can't drop them like this, but you know, you can handle them. If it fell out of your fingers and went, you know, 2 or 3 inches on the table, it wouldn't, for the most part, shatter. A wax ambrel would. I feel very comfortable with brown wax. I think it's a much more durable format than people give it credit for. It's the fact it's hitting that magic 100-year mark that might create a little bit of maybe a psychological point of view in that, you know, as far as fragility or something. Also, there's so much variation in brown wax too. So when you listen to them, some of them are very faint. Others are, I have some brown waxers almost as loud as black wax. And I'm not talking the transitional Columbia ones. I'm talking ones that were definitely recorded, you know, say 1898, 1899. They vary so much. So one other thing is, in the general comment, most of us have quite a few records. This one thing I've realized in terms of record wear is that how often do I ever play any one record? I don't play one record a million times. So, for example, I play them on the credenza. People go, oh my God, you're playing that great record on the credenza. Yeah, but I might play it 5 times over 10 years. So, and I'm not running an archive personally, so actually, depending, it's a matter of, you know, the context in which you're using the record. That's the editorial comment.
Wendy?
Well, I'd like to follow up on that comment. To have libraries or archives or other publicly accessible collections. Who are listening to these things? Is it a matter of people, specific scholars? Is it just people in this room? I think cylinders have a lot of wonderful information, but who knows about these things? A, these, who has, are we getting lots of connectivity, a lot of research?
Well, our cylinder collection at the moment and for years and years before is basically not being used. Until we have a good cylinder machine and are set up to have them properly transferred, we're not playing them. But I noticed just this year with the 100th anniversary of the Spanish-American War that requests for recordings of that era really rose. So just that's an example. We had I believe 4 requests from people doing documentaries on the Spanish-American War for recordings from the late 1890s. So that's an example.
Yeah,
Thanks, Sarah. Is there another archivist who'd like to comment on the use of their collections? Sam.
I was saying that all archives have a lot of materials that aren't used. It's our responsibility to sort of build use for them. I think that's going to become easier with cylinders for two reasons. A, we're getting the machines now that can play them. I wanted to ask Bill to comment on Glenn Sage too. Someone talked about getting the machines, their cylinders transferred, but somebody's putting them up on the web. The cylinders, the Edison group, is the one bulk of recording that is made before the music's copyrighted. In this case, from 1923, we can put them on the web. And that's what the Library of Congress is doing, and that's what other people are doing. It's the one recording that we can freely distribute to give away. Jerry has arranged for two cylinder machines to be purchased. He mentioned that there's sort of a conflict on their valuation. It's basically one is a perfectionist who wants a machine to play brown wax, and that didn't prove so well. And the person who thought it was a great machine is someone who, it is a good machine, someone who hates the cylinders because he used to work for the Dictaphone Company. And this is better than any machine Dictaphone ever made. It does play blue and gold and think well. The problem with brown wax is another question entirely. But to answer the question, no, they're not being used. Yes, I agree that there's good material on them. And I just see that as my responsibility to see that they are used. Otherwise, eventually. And I think having the machines to transfer them and getting the websites up that have them on there, we will have some on our Spanish American War website, along with the paper prints and things, will rectify that to some sense. So we won't publish a lot of them because there's a lot of political pressure.
I may want to add something, and over at R&H too, we wound up with a pile of very, very unusual cylinders that were part of Walter Toscanini's collection that recently Walfredo Toscanini donated to us, that was on hold, if I'm correct, they were done down in South America, probably around the turn of the century, of singers that none of them had made any commercial records on, we had checked, with the exception of one of the singers. And as of yet, we're not going to touch them until we're 100% sure we can play them back without destroying them. They are literally almost 100 years old at this stage. But many a times, if we're not sure, it's better safe than sorry than to do something and then regret it later on.
Jerry?
If I understood what the question is, who would want to listen to the cylinders, my paper in Kansas City 2 years ago was on the subject of some apparently lost cylinders. If anyone ever turned up 400 Putney cylinders that I described in my paper, this would be more than just a curiosity. These would be of enormous interest to musicologists. I say that from my point of view on that particular series. I would gather from that there must be some other recordings on the earliest cylinders that might be of equal value to the people who work in whatever field they're in.
Well, it's just like, was it the Pathé Company, did all their masters on cylinders and then panographic dubs to different sizes and different speeds depending on what kind of playback machines they were going to be played on. To this day, no one has ever seen one of those original cylinder masters. What has happened to them, what was done in New York and in France, has just completely gone the way of the dodo bird.
And I just want to say, it's not my question, it's who would want to listen to
me. That's a broad answer.
I think everyone would want to see. I think who is.
I just want to bring out, I remember, what was that massive project worked on? Music from the New York Stage original cast recordings from 1890 to 1920. Thank goodness for people like Jack Raymond, who went across the country to various collectors, put a Technics tape recorder in the back of his car, brought a turntable with him, or get dubs from people. I think one of the earliest things we had in there was, I think it was a commercial Columbia cylinder of DeWolf Hopper, which was Hedda Hopper's father, who made a zillion recordings, I think Casey at the Bat, but from one of his original shows at the time it premiered in 1890 or 91. Mm-hmm. I don't think the cylinder survives anymore. When he got it from whoever the collector was, several... Yeah, he had a tape dub. I don't, which he must have gotten close to 30 years ago. I don't know if that cylinder is still in existence, but you can hear what's going on, but it's a very, very important artifact of something that would be cast to the wind.
David.
Is Marty Hansen still here?
What's the schedule like?
Yeah. Right. What? Yeah. Well, I remember back in 1990 at one of the local New York meetings of the AES, Bill Storm came down from here when he was working here. And some engineer had posed the question, oh, I heard something done with the laser and it sounded really good. And then Bill went into it and he said, well, was there anything else in the chain? Did they have equalizers, filters? Yeah. But he had come up at the time with that. He said he found it very frustrating working at least with the early lasers that they were experimenting with up here, that the results were better with the stylus. But then, of course, we're dealing back in anywhere from the mid to late 80s. And, of course, whatever computers, you know, processors, we were at the mercy of at that point. Just like all the record companies now want to redo everything they did in the 80s because they knew the analog to digital converters they were using were absolute garbage, that were not giving you the proper, frequency response in converting to a digital signal to make a CD master. And then the higher bit rates we're going to. We're always going to be reinventing the wheel on these things. We just have to hope and pray the original sources will hold up to the point that we can get it to that. That we can actually preserve these things as mirror images without any interference.
Steve?
I think there's an important distinction to be drawn here as a result of the question that Wendy raised. And that is between the people who are interested in getting the audio from the cylinder and transfer it to some other medium, which then becomes a storage for that cylinder, and that cylinder then becomes more or less an object, a museum object within the institution. To which I must add that it's very important then to make sure that that transfer has been cataloged so that you don't end up doing it again when you're in some kind of a suite situation. God forbid you really get funded for one of these things. So that's more or less the importance of getting the historical audio, so to speak, as opposed to the collector, since the question came up of how many times the cylinder will be played, where a collector is really, in many cases, interested in using it as an integral part of a demonstration of a machine with an interesting...
Marty Hansen still here.
I think we'll close out the demo later on.
What's the schedule like?
Yeah.
I think Marty could address that, and we're supposed to have a demo maybe Saturday.
Right. What? Yeah. Well, I remember back in 1990 at one of the local New York meetings of the AES, Bill Storm came down from here when he was working here, and some engineer had posed the question, oh, I heard something done with the laser and it sounded really good. And then Bill went into it and he said, well, was there anything else in the chain? Did they have equalizers, filters? Yeah. But he had come up at the time with that. He said he found it very frustrating working at least with the early lasers that they were experimenting with up here, that the results were better with the stylus. But then, of course, we're dealing back in anywhere from the mid to late 80s. And, of course, whatever computers, you know, processors, we were at the mercy of at that point. Just like
all the record companies now want to redo everything they did in the 80s because they knew the analog to digital converters they were using were absolute garbage, that were not giving you the proper, frequency response in converting to a digital signal to make a CD master. And then the higher bit rates we're going to. We're always going to be reinventing the wheel on these things. We just have to hope and pray the original sources will hold up to the point that we can get it to that. That we can actually preserve these things as mirror images without any interference.
Steve?
I think there's an important distinction to be drawn here as a result of the question that Wendy raised. And that is between the people who are interested in getting the audio from the cylinder and transfer it to some other medium, which then becomes a storage for that cylinder, and that cylinder then becomes more or less an object, a museum object within the institution, to which I must add that it's very important then to make sure that that transfer has been cataloged so that you don't end up doing it again when you're in some kind of a suite situation. God forbid you really get funded for one of these things. So that's more or less the importance of getting the historical audio, so to speak, as opposed to the collector, since the question came up of how many times the cylinder will be played, where a collector is really, in many cases, interested in using it as an integral part of a demonstration of a machine with an interesting audio artifact of the period, and that it works together as a unit and may be played together many times. And so that what we're really talking about here is using original equipment to play back the cylinder as many times as it can stand it, as opposed to using archivally considered equipment, which may have electrical pickups or whatever else, and then be transferred to some other medium. And I think that the two are almost equally exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tim Brooks raised a cry not long ago for cylinders to be respected. Do you want to say anything, Tim, about what your writing was, your little call there?
This is one talk here about cylinders ranging from 1890, I guess, to 1899 or whatever. Yeah. And 1890, as you know, probably the late 90s, is the period where the fewest of them, but the rarest, and those that are special are very those are the ones that if they disintegrate, the vascular cylinder for a little while before they disintegrate, it's gone. You'll never hear what the artist did or what was done in 1892 again. People who remember hearing it. So preservation of those items, and I would caution against making prejudgments about what's going to be historic too.
Yes.
I would want to try to transfer them with this little contact and a little damage and do it before or they're going to be another basket.
Mike, you had mentioned one time at one of the conferences, I think in 96, you were talking to someone that they're able to digitally scan, say, a film now and, can make a negative print off of that from a digital scan, if I'm correct?
That's been a conjecture that I've been making for years. I have not seen anything actually done that.
Well, maybe something could be done with the logistics of a cylinder, too, some sort of scanning process.
Yeah, because the tinfoil, of course, gets stretched out, and that's
right.
My feeling that you could do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that there would be a possibility to be able to make a flat picture of a cylinder and then be able to scan it. Something that should be thought about. Many, many years ago, when I was starting to do my research and doing microfilms off of sheets of paper, of pictures, I was thinking, also taking pictures of record labels, would it be nice if I could also take a microfilm that would include the grooves, which is of course what Robert Deutsch does, and be able to now play back that microfilm like you could play back that you could look at a picture on a microfilm. That sure would make reproduction of the records a lot quicker than real-time stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're right about at the end of our time. One last question or comment? Yes.
I'd like my two visitors to call out.
I'd like to make two emphasis comments. The first concerns your cylinder right at the beginning of this session. The shape of the cylinder is probably elliptical, and it should be able to measure the velocity of the cylinder as it's being played back, and you should probably be able to calculate what the variation of the velocity is. That will lead to a simple function for pitch velocity, so that if you have a digital recording, you should be able to apply a periodic pitch correction.
I think you said that done.
You're good, man.
Oh, there's one interpret?
Probably, so it's not consistent.
The other thing I'd like to speculate for scanning old materials is that in microscopy, there is now a whole collection of scanning microscopes which use various physical properties. They use atomic force, but weight, they use electrical properties, and others. There's such a collection of them that it's difficult to keep track of them. They all utilize kits for the scanning, which are of atomic or extremely small dimension, so that a phonograph groove is like a mountain trough. Mm-hmm. The mountain valley to them, but it's always been my thought that these could be adjusted for things like phonograph records and cylinders, and although there would be some contact involved, it would be so minute that there could be no question of damage.
Yeah, thank you. Mike, you get one last word if you had a comment.
No, that wasn't.
Okay. I guess that'll do it then. Thank you.
I want to thank the cylinder subcommittee for waxing eloquently about cylinders. Yes, and there's coffee and goodies over on the side, and we'll reconvene in 15 minutes.